Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Haunted New Orleans, History and Hauntings of the Crescent City, by Troy Taylor. Narrated by Graham Rowett. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to visual elements present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Introduction. The very name, New Orleans, conjures up a succulent variety of thoughts in the mind of anyone who hears it. The soft sounds of jazz, whirring ceiling fans, wrought iron gates, and hot, spicy food. Along the swollen Mississippi River, the city dozes, only to come alive at night with the revelry of its people and the blare of music and laughter from Bourbon Street and the French Quarter. These are the images of New Orleans that many people think of. But there is another side to the city as well, an underbelly and a darkness that is as carefully hidden as the gates to the small courtyards that lurk between buildings in the French Quarter. This dark side is there, just like the spectacular gardens and courtyards, but you have to know where to look for it. And if you don't see it at first, don't worry, because it's liable to sneak up and surprise you when you least expect it. The dark side of New Orleans is as much a part of the city as chicory-laced coffee and beignets, and is filled with the seductive imagery of voodoo, murder, and ghosts. Only in New Orleans could darkness and death seem so appealing. New Orleans was established in the earliest days of the 18th century. The first colonists to stake a claim to the swampy lands were of French origin. They came to this hot and waterlogged place in the early 1700s, preceded only by explorers like La Salle, who came down the Mississippi River in 1682 and claimed the land where the river ended for France. In 1699, two French-Canadian explorers named Pierre Lemoyne and Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne sailed in from the Caribbean and landed on a tiny bayou near the future site of the city. Since the Catholic holiday of Fat Tuesday fell on the next day, they called the spot Pointe de Mardi Gras. Exploring the New World was not all about adventure. It was also about money. Colonies and exploration were expensive, and by 1700 the French were broke. The Bourbons of France were approached by a Scottish man named John Law, who created a New World company in which the French could invest and thereby settle the lower Mississippi Valley. In reality, the plan was a scheme to bilk money from the investors in return for selling them Louisiana. Law was given a monopoly on trade as well. Later, when it turned out that Law's company was merely a large confidence game, many of the settlers decided to ignore this and stay on. During the first year of Law's operation, he decided that a town should be founded at a spot that could be reached from both Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River. In 1718, this town became La Nouvelle Orléans. Development of the city began that year, but work was slow, thanks to brutal heat and the rising and falling waters of the Mississippi. There was talk of moving the city because of the danger of flooding, so levees were constructed, which spread out as the city and the plantations of the area grew. But rising water was not the only danger that could be found at the mouth of the Mississippi. In many early documents, writers spoke of the monsters that dwelt in the murky waters, and the Indian legends told of gigantic beasts that waited to spring upon unwary travelers. "May God preserve us from the crocodiles," wrote Father Louis Hennepin. Meanwhile, John Law was having problems holding up his end of the bargain that he made with the French. In order to get his money, he had promised his investors that he would have a colony of 6,000 settlers and 3,000 slaves by 1727. His problem, however, was a shortage of women. The colony's governor, Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne, Sieur de Bienville, wrote, "The white men are running in the woods after the Indian girls." About 1720, one solution to cure the shortage of women arrived when the jails of Paris were emptied of prostitutes. The ladies of the evening were given a choice: serve their term in prison or become a colonist in Louisiana. Those who chose the New World quickly became the wives of the men most starved for female companionship. The prisons also served as a source for male colonists. Many thieves, vagabonds, deserters, and smugglers also chose to come to Louisiana to avoid prison time. They made for strange company when mixed with aristocrats, indicted for some wrongdoing or another, who also chose New Orleans over the Bastille. New Orleans also lacked education and medical care. Despairing over the conditions, Governor Bienville coaxed the Sisters of Ursuline to come from France and assist the new city. The first Ursulines arrived in 1727 and set to work caring for orphans, operating a school, setting up a free hospital, and instructing slaves for baptism. They also provided a safe haven for the Casket Girls, young middle-class girls who had come in answer to the call for suitable wives. The young women were so named for either the distinctively shaped hats they wore or for the government-issued casket-shaped chests of clothes and linen they brought with them. No one can say where the name came from, but it stuck. The first of the Casket Girls arrived in 1728, and they continued to come until 1751, marrying those single male colonists who had been unable to snag one of the professional girls who had been sent from the Paris jails a few years before. Despite these advances, things were far from perfect in the colony. There was great unrest among the local Chickasaw Indian tribes. Governor Bienville, who was respected for his diplomacy, managed to make peace with the Indians, but it turned out to be short-lived. Thanks to political issues, Bienville was eventually recalled to France, and the unsteady peace with the Indians began to deteriorate. In 1729, Natchez Indians, allies of the Chickasaw, attacked Fort Rosalie at Natchez, slaughtering about 250 settlers and kidnapping 450 women, children, and slaves. Many feared that New Orleans would be next. The nearby Indian attacks, combined with the political disorder of the time, caused the investors in John Law's company to petition France to get rid of the unprofitable Louisiana colony. Bowing to financial pressure, France abandoned the colony, leaving behind more than 7,000 sturdy and hard-bitten colonists in one of the farthest outposts of the New World. New Orleans faced an uncertain future. In 1762, France passed the ownership of Louisiana to Spain in the secret Treaty of Fontainebleau. That same year, Spain entered the Seven Years' War, the European arm of the French and Indian War, just in time to share defeat with France. As part of the Treaty of Paris at the end of the war, France had to give up its holdings in North America. New Orleans and Louisiana, however, had been given to Spain the previous year. No one in Louisiana had any indication of this for months. Then, suddenly, the colonists found themselves under the control of the much-hated Spanish governor, Don Antonio de Ulloa, an insult they did not intend to stomach for long. In 1768, 600 New Orleans citizens mounted the first revolutionary expedition of Americans against a European government. The ranks were made up of Acadians, French-speaking immigrants from Canada, who had been told they were going to be sold into slavery by the Spanish and German immigrants. They also believed the Spanish were going to default on money owed to John Law's company. By November 1st, Don Antonio, terrified by the uprising, had escaped to Cuba, and the rebels took his three aides as prisoners. His Majesty Carlos of Spain was not amused by the revolution and sent a 2,600-man mercenary army to New Orleans to retake the city. Don Alexander O'Reilly, an Irishman in the service of Spain, led the force. He later earned the nickname Bloody O'Reilly after he sent all of the revolutionaries before the firing squad. The Spanish remained in control of the city for a number of years after these events, but many changes were coming to the region. The refugees and adventurers of many nations were beginning to arrive in New Orleans. In 1765, the first shiploads of Acadians had arrived in New Orleans after being exiled and driven out of their homes in Nova Scotia. These simple farming people, of French origin, were fiercely protective of their freedom and had led the uprising against Spain in 1768. They remained in New Orleans for some time, but soon moved on into the bayous north and west of the city. They brought their language and customs into the swamps and backcountry, and eventually their name was slurred into the word Cajun. The descendants of these original settlers continue to thrive in this region today. Another great and catastrophic change came in March 1788, when the city of New Orleans was destroyed by fire. As the city was constructed almost entirely of wood, the flames quickly devoured it. The fire started on Good Friday, and because of the holiday, the Capuchin monks refused to allow the church bells to ring a warning to the populace. As a result, the fire was out of control before enough men could be gathered to try and stop it. Section after section of the city was destroyed, including the government house, the jails, the residences, the business section, the church, and, ironically, even the monastery of the monks who had refused to sound the bells. Only a row of houses along the levee was spared, along with the Ursuline convent, which had been built of brick and tile. The convent records say that the building was saved by a miracle. The city that fell in the fire was a congested French community of poorly built wooden homes that had been badly arranged. Thanks to the Spanish, the city that took its place is still the Vieux Carré, French Quarter, that we know today. As the rebuilding began, the Spanish architects and builders took part in the construction. The city that came from the ashes was one of brick and plaster, with heavy arches and roofs of tile. The buildings were erected flush against the sidewalks, balconies overhung the streets, and shaded courtyards were placed between and behind the stately homes, hiding banana trees, fountains, and flowers. New homes and businesses began to appear, and some would say that the fire was actually a blessing to the city. A prominent member of the community was a man named Don Andrés Alomonastery Rojas. He was a Spaniard of noble birth and the richest man in New Orleans. He was vexed by the fire and declared that he would build a new church for the city, a new hospital, a new government building, and a monastery for the Capuchins. He donated the money and the materials, and those four buildings still stand at the edge of Jackson Square today. In 1850, renovations were made to the roofs of the buildings that flanked the cathedral, and the central spire was added to the Church of Saint-Louis. But basically, they are the same buildings that Don Alomonaster completed in 1795. He is now buried near the altar in the cathedral. The first real hope for the French settlers in New Orleans that they might someday be governed by France again came in the 1790s, when news of the events taking place during the French Revolution reached the colony. Many of the residents became filled with patriotism, and there were cries for liberty in the theaters and public spaces. When the news of the execution of Louis XVI reached New Orleans, there was open celebration. Governor Carondelet, fearing another uprising, had six prominent French leaders arrested and exiled to Cuba for 1 year. He also began to fortify the city, erecting a masonry wall around the original Vieux Carré with stockades at the corners. Two of them faced the river, and two faced the swamps beyond the city. The fortifications, he explained, were not to protect New Orleans from the French, but rather from the Americans, from whom he feared an invasion was imminent. Carondelet was succeeded in 1797 by another Spaniard, Don Manuel Gayoso de Lemos, beginning the golden age of the Spanish in New Orleans. While this period only lasted for 2 years, it marks a time when the city truly began to grow and prosper, and after this, it would forever be known as the most important port on the Caribbean. In 1800, the people of New Orleans discovered that the city had been given back to Napoleon of France as a result of the secret treaty of San Ildefonso. But Napoleon was busy that year conquering the Turks, the Austrians, and the Italians, plus ending a slave uprising on Saint-Domingue. Since New Orleans was struck with a terrible yellow fever epidemic, he allowed the Spanish to continue governing the colony. Soon, another group began to influence the culture of the city. The residents called them the Cane Talks, and these buckskin-clad American frontiersmen descended on the city in force. The shrewd Americans had realized the potential of the thriving port of the city and had begun bringing keelboats loaded with goods down the Mississippi. In 1804, the city would belong to America. Napoleon needed money, and thanks to some stiff bargaining by President Thomas Jefferson, the Louisiana Territory, which comprised more than 600 million acres, was soon in the possession of the United States. The cost of the territory, which stretched from the Mississippi to the Pacific Ocean, was about $15 million, which makes it one of the greatest land deals in history. The transfer of New Orleans took place in the balcony of the Cabildo off Jackson Square. The city, along with the rest of the Louisiana Territory, was formally given to General Wilkinson and W.C.C. Claiborne, the commissioners appointed by President Jefferson. New Orleans was now officially an American city, a fact that was met with dismay by the people of New Orleans. The city considered itself highly civilized and equated the word American with barbarian. The only Americans the Creole residents of the city were familiar with were rough frontiersmen and the even more intolerable flatboat men. These men gave endless trouble to the police for fighting and public drunkenness and, in addition, spoke an uncouth and alien language. This was the general impression of all Americans, and the arrival of the first settlers from the United States did nothing to change this way of thinking. Little business was conducted between the two groups, and the American women were snubbed by the Creole ladies. Because of this, the Americans created a society of their own, and eventually created their own section of the city, outside the boundaries of the Vieux Carré. Altercations between the Creole and the Americans were not infrequent, and at last a boundary was created between the two societies. A strip of land between the French Quarter and the American section was designated as a neutral ground by an act of Congress in 1807. It later became known as Canal Street. By 1810, with its mixture of French and Spanish-speaking Creoles, Anglo-Americans, slaves, and free people of color, New Orleans was established as the largest city in the South and the fifth largest city in America. The city had truly come into its own, a fact that was proven in 1812 when the steamboat New Orleans arrived in port and ushered in a new period of prosperity. The aristocrats of the city filled their lavish mansions with the finest Persian rugs, crystal chandeliers, and the best French wines that money could buy. However, luxuries aside, New Orleans was not a place for the weak and sickly. Located below sea level, in a hot and humid climate, it was a place of oppressive humidity from June to October and was infested with mosquitoes. The city was often hit with terrible cholera and tropical illness epidemics and was labeled a damp grave for those foolish enough to live there. In addition, there were the hurricanes, thunderstorms from the Gulf of Mexico, and the frequent floods. The spring flooding would usually pour about 2 feet of muddy water and debris into the city, not to mention snakes and rats. New levees were constructed each time the devastation hit the city, but each time, the damage was horrible. In 1832, New Orleans was savaged by a cholera epidemic, and between 1817 and 1860, there were 23 outbreaks of yellow fever. This wicked disease was spread by mosquitoes, which bred in household cisterns, although no one knew it at the time. The most serious epidemic of yellow fever hit the city in 1853, sending thousands to higher ground in surrounding cities like Natchez and Mobile. More than 8,000 people died before the cool months of fall arrived. Those not felled by the disease struggled to find its cause. Days of prayer were organized, and cannons were blasted each day to break up the clouds over the city, thinking that perhaps they were responsible for the disease. Hurricanes, floods, and epidemics aside, Louisiana became the 18th state in the Union on April 30, 1812. Barely a month later, Congress declared war on Britain. A few weeks after Mardi Gras in 1814, rumors filled the city that the British were going to attack New Orleans. The Battle of New Orleans. If there was one thing that could bring together the opposing forces in New Orleans, the Catholic Creoles and the Protestant Americans, it was a threat from the British. The people of New Orleans, who still consider themselves mostly Spanish or French, were long used to being governed by enemies of Britain. As for the Americans, the bitterness from hard-won independence they had achieved from England still lingered in recent memory. The last thing they wanted was to fall under the thumb of the British once again. With this in mind, the Creoles and the Americans began to rally together. The coming battle would be just the catalyst to showcase the bravery of all the people of New Orleans, if they managed to survive it. Unfortunately, the city was defenseless. Word reached New Orleans that the Capitol and the White House in Washington had been burned, and that President James Madison was unable to raise an army because the United States Treasury was empty. If Washington could not be saved, what would become of New Orleans? The city was in chaos when General Andrew Jackson arrived. The crusty Indian fighter had come to New Orleans already in 1812 when the British first threatened the city. After arriving at the mouth of the Mississippi with his men from Tennessee, he was ordered to disband his army and return home. Disgusted, Jackson fought the Creek Indians before being sent back to New Orleans in 1814. He arrived in New Orleans in December, only to be confined to his bed with dysentery and a high fever. In spite of his health, he still managed to quickly organize a defense of the city. He imposed martial law and enlisted the aid of every breathing human being who could fire a gun. He soon accepted the assistance of the regiments of free people of color, Kentuckians, who came downriver on flatboats, Choctaw Indians, and, of course, pirate brigades under the command of Jean Lafitte and his brother Pierre. Of all the pirates who sailed the Caribbean, preying on merchant ships and slave ships, there are none who gained as much fame in New Orleans as Jean Lafitte. Operating from the bayous south of New Orleans, he was only saved from the noose because of his aid to General Jackson during the Battle of New Orleans. The Lafitte brothers had opened a blacksmith shop in New Orleans in 1809 that served as a front for their smuggling operation, which dealt in slaves and stolen goods. A year later, Jean Lafitte formed a loose band of pirates, privateers, and smugglers based in Barataria Bay, located south of the city. Over the next few years, they raided ships in the Gulf of Mexico, concentrating mainly on Spanish galleons and slave traders. Even after slave trading was outlawed in Louisiana, plantation owners attended secret auctions in the bayous. There, merchants were also able to purchase low-cost, plundered goods from the pirates. Eventually, the secret meetings became too well known, and the brothers Lafitte were charged with piracy and illegal trading. Released on bail, they escaped the city and continued their operations. A bounty of $500 was placed on Lafitte's head in 1813, and he arrogantly responded by posting bills advertising a price of $5,000 for the head of the governor. The disagreement over maritime conditions that led to the War of 1812 erupted and went badly for the Americans. Not only were the invasions of Canada repulsed, but the fledgling American naval captains also found themselves blockaded from entering their own ports by the superior British fleet. At New Orleans, the British wanted to continue the success they had found in Maryland and Washington by attacking New Orleans and disrupting transport on the Mississippi River. In September 1814, British officers offered Jean Lafitte a pardon and a rich reward if he and his pirates would help them attack New Orleans. Lafitte had no love for the British and quickly informed the American authorities of the impending attack. Lafitte's information did not garner him a reward from the Americans, though. Instead, Barataria Bay was invaded by American ships, which captured the pirate fleet as it lay at anchor. Lafitte and his men managed to hide out in the swamps until the Navy left, and then they reclaimed their settlement. When Andrew Jackson arrived in New Orleans a short time later, things changed for the pirates. Jackson, having never been accused of being conventional, realized that Lafitte and his men could offer much for the defense of the city. Jackson quickly made a practical offer to Lafitte. Help save the city, and Jackson would see to it that Lafitte was offered a pardon for his crimes. Lafitte agreed, and his men manned guns that had been taken from two warships during the fighting. 1 month after the battle, Lafitte was given a full pardon by President Madison. Rather than remain in New Orleans, the new national hero went back to being a pirate. He and his men sailed for Texas, a lawless frontier region located between America and Spanish Mexico. They established a port at Galveston, and within a year the area became a haven for criminals and smugglers. While Lafitte mostly preyed on Spanish ships from Mexico, he made the mistake of attacking several American ships in 1819. This led to an outcry, and a naval expedition was dispatched against him. In 1820, a naval force headed by the USS Enterprise bombarded and destroyed Galveston. Lafitte escaped capture, but what became of him is unknown. Most believe that he died of yellow fever in Mexico in 1826. Lafitte and his pirates played an important role in the Battle of New Orleans, but the savior of the city was General Andrew Jackson himself. On December 23, 1814, Jackson attacked the British troops who were camped along the banks of the Mississippi. The British forces were led by General Pakenham, and although fresh from defeating Napoleon, they suffered a severe blow at the hands of ragtag troops made up of Kentuckian long rifles, ill-prepared militiamen, Indians, Creoles, free men of color, and pirates. The fighting raged back and forth for several bitterly cold days between Christmas and New Year's Day. The British were continually reinforced with fresh troops until they greatly outnumbered the American forces in New Orleans. On New Year's Day, the British attacked the city's defenses, only to be driven back. Then on January 8th, the final battle took place on the muddy and mist-covered grounds of Chalmette Plantation. The Americans huddled behind bales of straw and cotton, and soon began to hear the ghostly sounds of bagpipes and drums coming from the fog. Soon, they were able to see the colors of the Duchess of York's light dragoons and the tartans of the 93rd Highlanders. The British troops charged, advancing in tight, efficient lines. But the combat-hardened troops were no match for the desperate men of New Orleans. The militiamen, the hastily organized regiments, and the pirates savagely blasted the British lines without mercy. By later that day, Jackson's army had prevailed, with only 15 men dead and 40 wounded. The British were not so lucky. The carnage on their side consisted of 858 dead and about 2,500 men wounded. They had nowhere to turn for medical care, and legend has it that they sought refuge with the Ursuline sisters, who would turn no one away. The stories say that many enemy troops were hidden within their walls long after the fighting had ended. Ironically, soon after the battle, news finally reached the city that the British had signed a peace treaty at Ghent on Christmas Eve, 2 weeks before the Battle of New Orleans. The Civil War in New Orleans. By the start of the Civil War, New Orleans had the largest cotton market in the world and was, by far, the wealthiest city in America. It had been an American city for just over 50 years when it found itself embroiled in war. On February 4, 1861, Senator Judah P. Benjamin announced to Congress that Louisiana had seceded from the Union. The state would stand alone for 3 entire months until it joined the Confederate States of America. The decision to secede was not popular with everyone in New Orleans, especially with the merchants who depended on the northern markets to earn their livings. There were also problems raised for the free people of color in the city, who were now at war with a union that proposed not only the abolition of slavery, but also the power to vote and the right of public education for all people of color. However, despite this volatile mixture of emotions, when the war began, it would be General Pierre-Gustave Toton Beauregard and his regiment of Louisiana men who would open fire on Fort Sumter on April 12, 1861. The war in New Orleans came early, and the city spent the greatest amount of the war under Union control, despite being located so deep in Confederate territory. The Union almost immediately began its blockade of the Mississippi River and cut off the city from its imported supplies of flour, paper, and coffee. Plans were soon made for the capture of the city itself. The fall of New Orleans would be catastrophic for the Confederacy and would enable the federal forces to divide the South by controlling the Mississippi River. In April 1862, a fleet of 24 ships under command of David G. Farragut was ordered to seize New Orleans. To reach the city, Farragut's ships had to sail upriver past Fort Jackson and Fort St. Philip. Commander David Dixon Porter, Farragut's younger foster brother, came up with a reckless plan. They would send a collection.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?